The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2016 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2016. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at accsedu.org.
All right. Well, since people are still trickling in, I'm just going to tell all my funny stories right now, so you can gloat later. When I was in the fifth grade, I already warned you that fifth grade is my year of doubt. And that doubt was not of classical education, the doubt was of education entirely, as opposed to baseball or any other things like that, which I did not doubt. I did not doubt them one little bit. In this talk, I'm going to be kind of referencing what I spoke about yesterday and also in my workshop the day before and trying to tie it all up in a bow. But first, some of the autobiographical. So in the fifth grade, I quit doing school, period. I just quit. I decided that I was done. I had learned plenty, thank you very much, and it's been great. I wasn't angry, I wasn't bitter, I wasn't resentful, I was just done. I completed my task educationally. And so I ceased all participation. And having a great fifth grade teacher in a good school, my parents received word of this cessation rather quickly. So I don't think I made it a week. It was about a week, and we had these calendars with stamps every day. You know, where at the end of the week, you'd take your calendar home and you'd get a stamp, or you'd say F on math instead of a stamp, something like that. And I took a calendar home that was just no stamps at all. And I think this was sort of an early graduation into dialectic, into the pert stage. And my parents sat me down, my father especially, and explained to me that I, contrary to my opinion, I was actually not done with my education. And that I would once again resume my work on my Latin homework, my math, my science, and every other thing that I quit. So I did. I did it all. And I actually had quit doing all my homework too. But prior to this, they'd never even had to tell me to do my homework. I'd just come home and do it. And then finally the lights turned on and I thought, why? And that's when it stopped. So my dad convinced me that I needed to be doing this because I wasn't being defiant. He just said, you need to do your homework. You're doing your homework. At some point, I will say this. I know historically, as an historian, I know that there ended up being a belt involved. But I have no memory of it. That part got just blacked out. It was erased from the archives. I do not remember that at all. So the following week, I then did my homework. I did my Latin, I did my math, I did my science, everything else. And then I threw it away. Right into the trash can. Go up to the teacher's desk to turn it in and just drop it in the trash. And go sit back down. So I took home another week's worth of stamps missing on my little calendar. And my father communicated with me about this. And we had a great meeting of the minds. And I said something very wise and astute, like he said something along the lines of, I thought I told you to do this, and I said, you did, but you never told me to turn it in. I don't care about man's approval. And that was, in fact, something that I said and meant. That was my approach. My tactic was, who cares about a grade, really, or about the approval of man? If I did it correctly, if I learned the stuff, this was the same kid who absolutely hated showing his work in math class. I would just write the answer down. And I would take pride in writing the answer down and then getting it wrong when it was right. Problem kid, right? In my own special way. So in this little micro mini rebellion, this is as rebellious as I ever got, my dad never ever tried to break that pugnacious spirit. Like, he never saw that as the problem. He just wanted to try to get it online, like get it in the right groove, get it pointed at the right things. The same thing I'll say to my son now. If he really wants to argue, you know, I'll tell him to save it for his teammates on the baseball team, not his sisters. Like, redirect, or this is where it goes. If you are feeling antsy, you want to fight, you want to tangle, that's great. If you're a 14-year-old boy, you want to tangle, there's plenty of people for you to tangle with. Let's go find someone. Like, tangle here. Like, direct your argumentative spirit in this direction, in a fruitful direction. So right around the time when I started doing all my work again and actually turning it in, again, my parents laugh about this, because this really was about 2 weeks long in the fifth grade. But it kind of defined my fifth grade year. I quit reading things. I just didn't want to read any other books anymore. I would go back to The Silver Chair. I would go back to The Horse and His Boy. I would go back to not just Lord of the Rings, but I would go back to those particular chapters in The Two Towers. Though that one section in Return of the King. And I would just revisit and revisit and revisit. Man, I hated Old Yeller. I hated Where the Red Fern Grows. I hated My Side of the Mountain. I hated. And I was moving into that hatred phase. And my mom, being an English teacher, was quite effective at breaking this. My two parents combined to shift this pattern. My mother sat me down on the couch, and she picked up a copy of King Solomon's Mines. And she flipped to a section called The Witch Hunt. And in The Witch Hunt, if you haven't read the story, this old book by the very, very strange H. Rider Haggard. In The Witch Hunt, a bunch of Zulu warriors are lined up, along with some English explorers, and this little shriveled witch comes out, and she's dancing around, and drums are beating, and she's jumping, and the rhythm is going, and it's bum, bum, bum. The prose is matching the beats, and your main characters are stressing out of the line, because every time she points to someone, she's identifying them as a witch, and they are immediately grabbed by the two men on either side and disemboweled, or just murdered there, thrown on their knees and killed. So I'm sitting there at the age of about 12, with my mother reading this to me. And right as, you know, number two or three is gutted in this scene, and the witch is coming towards the hero, she slaps the book down on the coffee table and says, you don't like to read new books. Anyway. And she left. She just left me there with the book. And I'm still hearing the drums. The drums are still going. Well, I picked it up, and I read it straight through, and from that moment on, I began to pursue older books. From that moment on, it was no longer, can I just go back to Lewis and Tolkien, Lewis and Tolkien, Lewis and Tolkien, but I discovered that there were other things, other stories. And it's kind of strange given that particular book, but also that there were stories in history that were going to excite me just as much as fictional stories. Historical narratives, stories of martyrs, you know, even from like Scripture, the Old Testament, the book of Acts, that would be as riveting, as exciting as anything I read in fiction. So that was part one. Part two is my father absolutely forbade me from complaining about a book at the dining room table. I was not allowed to unburden myself of my hatred for My Side of the Mountain at dinner. And again, if he had just said that, no more. That would be an example of sitting on something and trying to suppress that attitude, trying to suppress that rebellion. But that's not what he did. So he didn't just say, shut up, kid, which would have been tempting, I'm sure. Instead, what he said is, shut up, kid, unless you have an edit, unless you have a constructive adjustment to the story to propose. So tell me what would make My Side of the Mountain. I'm sorry to be beating up on My Side of the Mountain, because it's a great little book in its own little kind of really boring way. It's like a cookie with no chocolate chips. So anyway, I began working on pitching new stuff. So here's what this book is boring, here's what I would do. This book is terrible, this is what I think should happen. And my sisters were also both very talkative, so it was hardly just me at the dinner table. They had many other things to discuss. Lots of discussion at the dinner table. And for me, it was sports and books and all the things that I would change about books. I tell kids when I'm doing school visits and I talk to quote-unquote reluctant readers, especially boys. It's like, if you're reading something like My Side of the Mountain or Old Yeller, add pirates. Kill off the characters you don't like. Change the shape of the story. Begin to map your own plots. But really what it came down to for me was that Lewis and Tolkien and my father's own storytelling and his own storytelling of Scripture and the stories we heard, the oral storytellers that we had in both of my grandfathers, the stories of Korea and World War II and childhood on the California coast or in Nebraska living in a chicken coop during the Depression. The stories that were told were the stories that kind of set the bar. They were the defining calibration for what was good and fun and glorious to listen to or to read. So my mom kind of baited a hook and tricked me into wanting to hunt through the library for more than Incredible Hulk comic books and just rereading Lewis and Tolkien. And my dad engaged me with books that I didn't like in a new and exciting way. So books ceased to be entertainment, and stories became a thing to be pushed against, a thing to be refined, a thing to be loved and engaged with, not something just to be received like a baby bird. Like, I had done that. I had been the baby bird starting at the age of 2, the first time I heard The Lord of the Rings, strapped in a high chair while my father read it aloud through it to my 5-year-old sister, 4-year-old sister actually at the time. And there was some debate over whether or not I followed any of it. My mom did not believe that I was listening at all as a 2-year-old in a high chair. My dad would point out that I was bright red and sweaty in all of the battle scenes. So if you think about grammar, the baby bird phase, I had done that. And as I came out of that, there was a necessary transition into engagement and criticism and dissection. And inevitably, coming out of that, there came the need for creation, rhetoric. So around the 6th grade and moving, I mean, really 6th grade, junior high-ish, but I kind of date it in that 6th grade year, I announced that stories were my gig. This is what I'm going to do. You know, the totally ignorant kid who has no idea what goes into this, even writing a novel. Yeah, still at that point would really struggle with a 3-page paper. I made the announcement that this was it. I'm going to write books. I'm going to write books like Lewis and Tolkien. I didn't even know what that meant other than I wanted to chase that aroma, that flavor, that soul, that taste, and the kind of impact they had on me. And then I immediately wrote a short story, and my grandfather was very real with me about it. The Wilson family does not struggle with criticism. Grandchildren are not to be coddled. So he gave me some very blunt feedback on a short story. And then I probably bailed on that and didn't try again until I just got craft, prose craft, correct. But I tell all this story. I tell this kind of like this autobiographical rise and, you know, ebb and flow of my own pursuit of storytelling out of the classical model, because I think that this happens for virtually every kid. It happens differently. Not everybody comes out resolving to write novels, but all of my friends went through the same kind of transition of just, like I said, the baby bird phase, and then a different kind of engagement and love and criticism with the stories we were consuming, and then a desire to engage more creatively. But unfortunately, as we hit that late phase, a lot of people revert back to the baby bird phase. What is available? What is playing on Friday? What movies are out? Which books are hot? And they simply consume. My title, my talk here is called Story Logic. And I think this subject is important because we tend to be very pendular people. We pick an analytical desire. This is something I referred to yesterday a little bit. We pick an analytical emphasis, a quantified emphasis. We like quantified subjects. We like to be able to tick off 9 out of 10, 19 out of 20, an easily graded thing. Or we really like the poetic, the creative, that side. And you see a lot of the weirdness of the modern world when somebody will get an 87 on a creative piece. And any kid, unfortunately, we're all the spawn of modernism. And so any kid using their head at all would go up to a teacher if they wrote a poem or they wrote a short story or they wrote a piece of creative nonfiction and they received an 87. They would go up to a teacher and say, 87% of what? I'm missing 13 things, apparently. Can you name them? Like, why are you imposing math here? Why is math ruling my creativity? And they have a valid point. You should stop that immediately. 87% out of a possible perfect short story, out of a possible perfect poem, or just kind of like, you lick your finger, 87. We quantify willy-nilly over the creative side, and we impose the analytical on the creative. Or on the flip side, you get the real, I don't think this happens in any of your schools, you get the real touchy-feely, doesn't really matter if you can't figure out the math. You know, think unschooling, think don't worry that you're stupid. This doesn't matter. The Pythagorean theorem just doesn't matter to me. Doesn't matter. Okay. A plus. Or just star. Something that's poetic over there on the quantified areas. Now, critical thinking is essential. This is the paragraph from your booklets. Critical thinking is essential for any faithful students, but so is critical feeling. In fact, in some ways, critical feeling is the more essential. Critical thinking is essential for any faithful student. Critical feeling is at the heart. Loyalties are not established through reason. They are established through narrative. Loves are not grown on a bed of premises, but on a bed of actions, real and imaginary. Narratives must make sense, and our sense absolutely must make narratives. You can't help it. You're living a story right now. You don't get to opt out. All men and women live and breathe in story, but faithful men and women strive to be wide-eyed students of the story, readers of the story, seers and sayers and retellers of the story in both word and deed. And that is what it means to be a disciple. And disciples are what our schools should aim to create. When I tell you that you all need to be storytellers, a number of you, I'm sure, would say, like, not really me. We'll leave that to Gregory over here, because he says he's artistic. Sorry, L. Gregory's in the audience. You opt out. I don't do that. I'm not a creative guy. I'm not a creative girl. Well, God says otherwise. You're telling a life story right now. Right now, you tell a life story. You write dialogue all the time. If you say, I'm not really a creative guy, I don't really tell stories, what you're telling me is you tell really, really bad ones. Not that you don't tell them. In your scenes with your children, in your scenes with your friends, in your scenes at church, in your scenes on the highway flipping off somebody at the stoplight. Not that anyone would ever do that. You're telling stories. You're writing dialogue. You're cultivating motivations, dreams, goals. You are writing a story. And the other thing that's crazy and strange is that you're writing a permanent one. You're writing one in wet concrete. And as soon as you do something, you have to move on. There's no editorial process here. None. Get it right on one go. You have 1 second to get it right, and then another second is on you. So here you are, live dialogue, and you etch it in stone and then move on. And God says, 87. No, it's not how he grades. We're all writing stories all the time. The more frightening thing to me, even than writing our own lives, is writing the lives of others, which is what you all are engaged in. Find me the craziest performance artist in New York City. Let's take him to the National Endowment for the Arts and have him pitch a little concept where he says, how about you give me an immortal soul in infancy and I will control everything. This will be my performance art. I'll take this human being, and this human being is going to live forever, and I'll start by naming them. And then I will start by whether or not there's any bedtime songs, or how much I'm frustrated at them crying with full britches, or what kind of preschool they should be in. I'm going to control everything, what they have on their birthday, what they eat for breakfast. I'm going to control everything about this immortal soul's life. I'm going to make a childhood. We would think that artist was out of their minds. Like, that's insane. Such a high-stakes game. You can't do that to another human, take a baby and then do this, except for we all do. All the time. God says, here. You think writing a novel is scary? How about one childhood, two childhoods, three childhoods? How about crafting a family culture? How about you, moms, have God tell your children to never abandon your law, the law of their mother? And then he says, okay, mom, we'll see what that law is. But he's already commanded them. The command is there. We are all telling stories. And those of us who are involved in the classical Christian school movement are trying to do, and many other people are as well, but trying to do as good a job as we possibly can, trying to craft additional helps to parents and families and churches to do this task, to raise faithful servants, faithful storytellers, faithful characters in the image of God. So let's assume that you are successful. Your school becomes the best school ever. And your goal is to train children in the use of deadly weapons. You say, okay, what's most important? Hand-to-hand combat, decapitation, guns, knife fighting, both overhand, underhand. We want people to work with explosives. We need combat. We're going to train kids in the use of deadly force. That's what our school's about. And it turns out you do a great job. Just fantastic. Your kids are deadly. All of your grads are highly employed by Blackwater and other groups. You become a bastion in the community. Everybody says, oh yes, very rigorous. Great SAT scores. But you, unfortunately, while you're covering all the how to kill a man silently in 10-second segments, you fail to teach faithfulness. Your snipers are the best high school snipers in the state. They can hit the targets of their choice, but they have no loyalty at all. You forgot to teach love, and you forgot to teach hate. Imagine what a profound disaster that would be. You train up a deadly force. Oh my, are they efficient. And you forget to put in the love, the hate, the loyalty. What could possibly go wrong? Well, what could possibly go wrong is going wrong right now. There are plenty of very, very smart graduates of ACCS schools without the love, without the loyalty, without the hate. Does anyone here speak inspirational visionary? Because that's what it takes. So how do you put the love in? How do you sit there and tell a bunch of kids, love this, hate that? It doesn't work that way. You can't just announce it and expect it to happen. Training your students in formal logic, training them in argumentation, training them in rhetoric is like training them to beat up their mom. If you don't put in the love, the hate, the loyalty, the faithfulness. They'll go at their mom in the kitchen, and guess what? Mom won't have a chance. They'll go at their church. They'll go at people that they should be honoring people that they should consider themselves allied to. You've taught them to fight. You're training fighters. When I think about my own pugnacious, rebellious streak at a very funny, amusing fifth, sixth grade level, if that hadn't been addressed the way it was, if that hadn't been cultivated the way it was, like, which targets would I have aimed at? Where would I have taken that rototiller mentality? There's not much scarier than a rototiller with nobody behind it steering, just going full speed. But instead of trying to sit on it or break it, which my parents didn't do, they directed it, and they directed it into creativity. They also directed it into overt combat. My dad took me places that I can't believe he did, really. One in particular where he was standing up, where he had to write a note to call the cops for the moderator beforehand, just in case, because they're already spitting and chanting and screaming. And I think I was around 12. And we got taken into this room, and he said, stick over there by that wall. And I was standing next to people who were screaming, spittle-flecked, purple veins, chanting, middle fingers up, signs that said, no hate here. This is a beautiful moment for a junior high student to capture, standing here looking at a guy screaming at his dad with a no hate here sign and a middle finger up on the other hand. It's like, picture, snap. It's a great little cartoon. And they were screaming things like, your children are ours, Doug. Your children are ours. And my dad was laughing. So they took us into combat. They showed us, like, where we should direct our aggression. And what I mean by aggression is that desire to argue, that desire to cut things down, to tear out branches. So we wouldn't just destroy things around the home. So do you speak inspirational visionary? Do you have that language? Are you able to communicate that to kids? Do the kids know, the kids you're teaching, do they know what team they're on? And do they feel like they were just born on it and they're stuck with it? Or do they know it and do they own it and do they love it? Is Augustine a brother and a friend and an ally? Is C.S. Lewis the best uncle they've ever had? Who is their family? To whom are they loyal? What has cultivated their loves? Finding a great Latin teacher is easier than finding someone who can march upstream against the roaring currents of our age, casting a contagious vision for truth, goodness, and beauty. Now, for some of you, that might seem difficult when I say finding a great Latin teacher is easy. Maybe not for a lot of you, but I can tell you that no matter where you are, finding someone good at Latin is a simpler task than finding someone who can make your kids fall in love with the truth and fall in love with it in a permanent and binding way. That's the goal. Can you vision cast? And not for your parents. I'm not talking about whether are you good at parent meetings where you're talking to other parents about how this would be good and you're saying, no, really, we'll teach them to be great with guns. They'll be deadly. I'm talking about vision casting to your students. Are the baby birds being fed those things which they will love on a fundamental level? Are they being taught how to hate on the dialectic level and even love and combat on the dialectic level? Do they have the right soul when they move into their own creative expression? While none of us can give God's efficacious grace, you never can. You cannot sit there with a kid in your class and say, I will now give you the effectual call. That's in God's hands. But what you can give them is grace. What you can do is show them how to love, how to hate. You can offer them the wholesome, glorious, fantastic meal that you prepared for them. And if they spit on it, they're sinning against greater light. You are either bringing grace or damnation to your students. If you're giving them advantages, if you're giving them the truth, then God will hold them to a higher standard. And you should be deeply concerned of trying to give them a fanatical love for God and His creation, for His art and for His story. We are all called to try to give efficacious grace. but it's not our job to make sure that it is efficacious. It needs to be wholesome. It needs to be glorious. It needs to be true, good, and beautiful. But we cannot guarantee that it will be received. That is God's job and His promise to parents. Now, unfortunately, rather than even trying, we are far more comfortable emphasizing those areas where success is more easily quantified. We love to go to that 87. We like doing well on standardized tests. Because it's great. That's the scoreboard, right? That's the scoreboard with the public schools. That's the scoreboard with the rest of the people who are involved in this pursuit, raising these permanent beings, training these permanent beings. Now, we go to quantified, and we end up with really good physics students. And then you think, oh, we need aesthetics. We need art. Who's artistic? Raise your hand. Sadly, those people who are artistic, those people who are all about the arts, I'm one of them, and the people that I hang out with, my friends, overwhelmingly, when they self-identify that way, they have already sort of fallen. They maybe have fallen in love with the rebellious romantics. They love Lord Byron. If only I too could ride around in a chariot. It's easy for people to be, oh, I love the arts. The arts are awesome. Run, and forget that there's even more discernment required there and more subtlety required there than there is when you're dealing with worldview analysis on a logical, syllogistic level. When you have a logic teacher, you can march through and say valid, invalid, sound, unsound. What's going on in this enthymeme? What's the assumed premise? Like, you can kind of tick the boxes and work your way through it, and that's great. It's important. But when you're saying, what do you think about Batman? A number of your teachers are going to get it wrong. A number of your parents are going to get it wrong. A number of your board members are going to get it wrong. This is the area where we are most vulnerable. And I even use a pop example, like a Batman, where we don't know how to break down and analyze. We can't figure out which parts to love and which parts to hate. Everyone here, this is a great charge, everyone here must be cooler than cool. When it comes down to it, you want to have the kind of school and the kind of teachers, and you want to have the kind of manner that has more weight with a 13-year-old kid than Hollywood, the entire music industry, all of their friends, and social media. You have to have that kind of coolness clout. And believe me, if you try to get there by just ordering pizza and sitting on a chair backwards and trying to be the youth pastor, it's not going to work. Although that's a start. Pizza is always a start. You must be cooler than cool. I said in my workshop that to say you have the truth, to say that you have the foundation of all that is true, good, and beautiful, but to say it in an ugly way is hypocrisy. To say, shut up, kid, this is beautiful. Hypocrisy. To say we have access to the creative Father, the infinite creative personality, and we're not going to be creative at all. We're attempting no creativity is hypocrisy. To say imitate your Father and then not to imitate him is hypocrisy. Aesthetic hypocrisy is a real thing. Also to say, oh, we love his creativity. Look at how glorious this is. Go to the millipede, you sluggard. Look at all this other stuff. Look at the giant centipede eating bats on the roof of a cave in Borneo. Look at what God is doing. Isn't that glorious? Look at all his art we're creating too. Man, I can't wait for the next Marvel movie. Why? I love it when I watch a movie with my kids, when I turn on a movie with my kids, and I've got a bunch of children, and I'm not saying the word, they're just like blowing raspberries, mocking it. Where I have to tell them to be quiet in the theater. It's like, we'll do it on the way home. Like, save it. I love my memories of sitting on the couch with my dad watching MTV at a young age, where he would say, now what worldview is that? We're watching Peter Gabriel. music videos. What's going on? What is he saying? Is it true? How is he saying it? What is he saying with the artistic expression? How is this communicating this? I was probably 9, 10, watching MTV on the couch with my dad. And my friends were so shocked by this. It's like, we were the really uptight family, but I'm watching MTV with the pastor. Wait a second. Our father told us that when we turned 16, we could watch any movie we wanted. We could listen to any music we wanted, and we could do it in the house. And then he added, because if you haven't figured it out by then, it's already too late. I've already messed up, and there's no hope. And we were all sort of like, okay. That's a little high stakes. And he said, the only caveat here is that you have to be able to explain to me why you're watching it and why you think it's important. You must be unintimidated, unafraid, not running in isolationistic. You don't want to be just retreating, hide, creating bubble children with no immune systems. You want to be raising children with passionate loves for the truth and inoculating them against the assaults of the enemy, engaging them with the assaults of the enemy at a very young age, and then raising the level of difficulty until you can release them into the wild without any fear of their victory. You are trying to raise dangerous people. You're trying to raise them in a very dangerous time, in an unfortunate way. We have some 40,000 students-ish in ACCS. If they were all dangerous, that would leave a very large mark. If other children spin and turn in their wakes as they push, that'll leave a very large mark. But unfortunately, the evangelical church has been we've provided the breeding cows, really, that's what we are, for unbelief. Because if you haven't noticed, the atheists don't have a lot of kids. And we do. And we pump them out, and we send them off to the state university, we send them off up there. It's like, hey, here, we've paid all the food bills, you go ahead and just ram your worldview in there, and we'll be good. They'll be ready for this moment in American history. We raise them, we feed them, we leave them ill-equipped, and we send them off to face a zeitgeist that is a torrent, an absolute torrent right now. We must all be cooler than cool. We must be joyful like our father. We must be raucous like our father is. We must be unexpected. We must tell stories like he tells. We need to be storytellers because it is stories that infuse these loyalties. In our schools, we frequently have grammar dialectic, and then this thing over here we have freeze-dried and pinned to a board. This thing called rhetoric. Okay, can you just follow this outline so I can tick it off and see how you did? Here's the classical structure. Make sure you go through the canons of rhetoric. And now let's make sure we have the exordium. Tick. Plus one. Let's move to the narratio. And then down through. And we check those boxes. And we have a real hard time saying, you know what? It wasn't moving. F. It's like, but the structure, the bones. Like, okay, great. Good job on the bones. F. That's hard for us to do. It wasn't powerful. It wasn't creative. Where's the soul? Where's the spice? Where's the metaphor? At what point did you sound like the prophet Elijah? And at what point did you sound like Christ? In grammar, we need to feed these baby birds and inspire them. In dialectic, we need to weaponize these birds, turn them into raptors, and then inspire them. In rhetoric, we inspire. And that's what we are doing. And we release. That's where we release them. We need to be inspiring them and causing them to love and causing them to be repulsed by and hate those things that their father loves and hates. How do we do that? By telling stories and not by neutering them. The PG-ification, the Disneyfication of the Old Testament is a real tragedy. I remember at a certain age, our dad told us Bible stories in a very unneutered way. but I remember looking at your picture Bibles and thinking, man, it's like the flood. The flood came because everybody stayed up a little bit past their bedtime and had a little too much to drink, I think. They looked like they might be tipsy. So they had a party. And God was so angry, he killed everyone. Where do your loyalties go in that story? Where do your loves shift? Wait, they kind of got a little rambunctious. I mean, I've jumped on the bed before. Once I put more than 40 nails in my wall through my Seahawks poster. And I even loved that Seahawks poster. It's like, I've done all sorts of things that apparently merit total annihilation. When you tell Bible stories, tell them correctly. Get the darkness right. Get the sin right. And then justice is not an overreaction. Get the sin right and the darkness right. Then holiness is no longer a fraud. If you have this PG evil, and then you bring hard R judgment, all you're doing is blaspheming the character of God. And you're telling these kids, God is the great overreactor in the sky. We do the same thing with Christ. We forget how violent he was, how destructive he was, how disrespectful and mouthy he was, how much he refused to answer questions, how much he stood people on their heads, how willing he was to have an entire crowd furious for the leaders of that age, ready to rip out his beard and crucify him. Be like that in your rhetoric. I remember coming home as a freshman in college and telling my dad the story of being thrown out of class and watching him just shake with laughter. He's like, so what happened? When did she throw the chalk at you? She wrote asshole on the board in giant letters and pointed at you and threw chalk? Yes. She did. Why? Because she told me to write a paper on why hedonistic nihilism was the only truly spiritual worldview. That's why. For 10% of my grade. Peer-reviewed. My paper is about this long. In which I said I had been a Christian and now I've realized that I was totally false. Finally, the lights have come on for me. I'm no longer a Christian. I realize I should always question authority and only do what I feel, and I really don't feel like writing this. My final line was, so I'm going to go steal an El Camino and plant a tree. That much. Stapled two blank pages on the back of it because I do follow rules. Three pages. It was very short, so the entire class was able to peer review it. Every single kid would read it and just look at me like, You're not really. Oh, yes, I am. So that was the first time I was thrown out of a college classroom. And I went home with that, and it was the cause of great rejoicing. Laughter. The first time I had a beer, I was 12. My mom put it in my stocking on Christmas. My parents had been unafraid. Like, unafraid, unintimidated by the world, not trying to shelter us, but leaning in. Incidentally, I hated that beer. It's horrible. My mom gave it to me, then immediately thought, this might not be a good idea. And my dad is like, Nancy, you gave it to him. He can drink it. So I sat there and drank a warm beer on Christmas morning. Not fun. Not fun. But I muscled through it. You must be joyful. We must be joyful. We must inspire at every level. And this is why I love to tell stories. These are the stories I want to tell. I want to try to do this for children. I tell people that I'm trying to cook for a crowd. That's what I'm doing. I'm just a guy in a kitchen trying to cook as many things that are like the stories I loved and fed on when I was young as possible as I can in my lifetime. How many meals can I put out? And no one novel is going to change the world. No one story is going to change the world. but over time, that food, that nourishment will. How much has Lewis changed over the decades with the Narnia Chronicles? How much of my own loves or your loves have been shaped by the Narnia Chronicles? It's really hard to rebel against a really joyful Christmas morning. It's really hard to rebel against the best pizza in the world. It's really hard to rebel against the fantastic aroma of baking bread. And if that's what your classrooms are like, then when they leave and they go somewhere else and they taste that, it is not difficult for them to hate and to love, to know where to fight, to know where to aim their rhetoric, where to aim their logic. So in rhetoric, because we can't quantify it, we tend to move it into a more lifeless outline, forensic structured form, something that's measurable, more easily measurable. Because it's difficult for us to learn how to do this, become communicators this way. Story is, after all, everything. All of us are stories. All of us are stories that are living right now. All of us are stories that have been told. And I've told my students this, I tell my kids this. You can be a cautionary tale. You can be an epic. You can be an adventure. But no matter what, if you live faithfully, you will be a good story. And you are writing that story and telling that story at all times. The goal for us is to tell the right kind of stories in the right way. To tell stories that actually match the darkness to the light. One of my pet peeves is Christian authors and Christian filmmakers who will be very, very, to get the world's approval, very, very realistic and gritty on the darkness side. Like, oh, it's real. It's really, really dark. And it's awful. And look how it's consuming these people and it's destroying their lives. And then grace comes. And I'm like, where's the grace? Like, I missed it. It's like, oh, you see over there, like that train that goes by in the distance, in the sun? That represents grace, metaphorically. It's like, okay. Like, so evil is very, very literal. And grace is this little glimpse of sun in the distance. Get it in balance. You must get it in balance. If you have literal evil, you need literal grace. If you want to be a hard-bitten Christian novelist who just writes Flannery O'Connor stories, which I love, by the way, make it match. Put it in the same universe. You want to tell the story of Samson? Do not stop before the resurrection. Samson has eyes now. What's the end of the story? The resurrection is the end of the story. Tell the story of Moses. Where is Moses now? There's a fight over that guy's body. Do your kids think of the battle between Moses and Pharaoh's magicians as something from the movie Prince of Egypt? Then you've totally failed them. Have you not told them the story of the first wizard duel in literature? Have you not told them where Gandalf comes from? That old guy walking out of the wilderness with the beard and what? The staff? Like, do you not know where this genre comes from? And this is the direct legacy. Gandalf's the legacy of Moses. Fantasy and wizard duels, all that stuff comes from Moses, the prophets. Have you not told them about Elijah? Did you leave out the PG-13 parts? Do your students know that there are unicorns in the Bible? Or did you neuter Job? Because it's embarrassing. Do you talk about the dragons in Isaiah? The sparks in Leviathan's nostrils? Or do you talk about dinosaurs and use the props and names of the other side? How do you tell your stories? Are your prophets fantastical? Are they amazing? Are the judges, is David amazing, mind-blowing? Have you told the stories of the whores in Christ's legacy? Have you talked about this? Have you really pointed out the fact that when the angels came down and celebrated the arrival of our King, the Creator King, he's humble enough that the audience he gathered to hear the greatest concert in history was mostly sheep, livestock, couple shepherds, but mostly sheep. And the angels came down from heaven to sing, could you bring your animals together? We're going to sing to the animals now. How do you tell your stories? Do you dodge the flood? Are you dodging unicorns, incidentally, in Job when God speaks out of the whirlwind and he says, can you harness the unicorn and make him plow your field? Most translations now translate that wild ox. Why? Oh, because we know there's no such thing as unicorns. So when the Bible says unicorn, we changed it to something else. Why? Because that's embarrassing. Why wild ox? Well, when you look at it sideways and the horns line up, that's why the ancients referred to that as one horned. And so God says to Job, can you harness the ox and make him plow your field? And Job goes, yes. What do you think I'm plowing with? Is there something else I should be using? The donkey was a problem. Unicorns, they're real. And incidentally, we're not talking about My Little Pony. That's the other ditch. We're talking about something that obviously cannot be harnessed and cannot be tamed. I wouldn't be surprised if it's a rhino. Can you harness the rhinoceros and make him plow your field? Okay, that works. No, he's stupid. And he's mean. Tell the stories. Are you scared of Genesis 6? Does that scare you? This is really funny to me because Genesis 6, okay, the sons of God lust after the daughters of men. Okay. And they give birth to giants. Giants! And now we have giant themes through all of Scripture. And when Christ descends, when he descends in death, where does he descend? He descends to the spirits that sinned in the time of Noah, to Numtio, to announce his victory. This is an old brawl. This is an old grudge match. It goes all the way back to the flood, when people were trying to vandalize the image of God, people, the sons of God, the fallen angels, and hijack reality, and they were destroyed. They weren't up past their bedtime. They were hijacking the entire planet, and it got reset. And after the crucifixion, that's where Christ went to announce his victory, to those spirits. And as a side note, oh wow, classical schools, we have all these stories about these giants rebelling against their creator. Weird. How could that be? Story is everything. The goal for us is to completely relinquish ownership of the story to our students. Your mouths will stop. It's one of those unfortunate things that we tend to pretend isn't real, but in this room, there's a 100% mortality rate. Every one of us is going to drop dead. Every one of us is going to go to dust. And the story will live on. The truth, goodness, beauty will live on, and we should be praying that it will live on in the mouths of our students. We speak it. We live it. We write that dialogue every time we have a conversation with them. Every time you stand in front of a class or sit at the dinner table and talk to your students, you're writing dialogue permanently etched in history. Another scene, another moment squandered, another moment of glory. Another moment of fantastic aroma of truth, goodness, and beauty, or another moment that's like, you fussed. You were kind of upset about how the table was set. Somebody was squirming in their seats because God made them that way. They squirmed, but they squirmed, God. They squirmed. You don't understand. I don't think you understand how to deal with a squirmy people. God, you don't get it. I never squirm. Ever. Every body in this room will die and rot. Every body in your classroom and all your classrooms will die and rot. New tongues will be entrusted with the truth or with decay. Your goal is to give loves. And if you could choose whether to have slightly higher test scores or to have students passionately in love with the truth, loyal to the truth, that should not be a difficult decision for you. That should be very easy. Yeah, okay, I'll take the slightly lower test scores and have a bunch of zealots. a bunch of students who love the lovely and are ready to damn the damnable. They're fearless because they know where they stand in the story. The goal is for us to be discipled by our disciples. May we all be surpassed by those behind us. May our backs be firm foundations for their feet as we go down. May the stories we live and tell create wide eyes and potent words and unbreakable bonds. That's the goal. Our goal is to make very, very dangerous disciples. Disciples who can in turn disciple us. Our goal is to make students who are more faithful than we are, more faithful than we were, more in love with God than we were, more creative, more joyful, and more dangerous. That's the task before us. And thank God for grace. Because all of us will fail all the time. You get on that Bronco, you try to ride that unicorn. Here, let's do this perfectly. Perfectly image God the Father and make that, all these loves, contagious for our students by means of story. Tell the stories, live the stories, read them the right books, and you'll get bucked right off. Somebody's going to throw a spit wad. Billy? Okay, fine. You became that character in the story. Once again, you became that character in the story. Once again, you're the fussy teacher. Once again, you're the uptight mom. Once again, you're the abdicating dad. Seek forgiveness, get grace, and get back on that Bronco. God is kind. The children we teach are actually His in a far more fundamental way than they are ours. They're entrusted to us, and we have a task. And the best way to achieve that task is with stories. Stories from His mouth, stories from history, stories that imitate His history, and the story of the fall, the gospel, and the eschaton. Let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for all the children who are represented here, for all the schools, for all the sweat, for all the labor, for all the fears of schools that are struggling, and for all the potential compromise and vision drift of those schools which are succeeding. Father, I pray that we would all image you effectively, dangerously, and with the fiery joy.